From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Big Pharma is big business in America. Behind those huge campaigns for Lipitor and Viagra are fat profits for the drug companies, but not necessarily better and certainly not cheaper drugs for consumers. My guest this hour, Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, is saying enough. American consumers, she says, deserve much better. Tonight on Point, an angry indictment of the drug industry and the drug industry's reply. But first, speaking to National Guard members in Las Vegas today, John Kerry accused President Bush of not presenting an honest picture of the troubles in Iraq. Kerry cited a classified intelligence assessment delivered to the president in July. Douglas Gell broke the news of that report today in the New York Times. I asked him what the intelligence services told the president about Iraq.
Those reports said that the prospects in the next 18 months for Iraq are not very good. They said that the best case would put Iraq in a very tenuous political, economic, and security situation. The worst would be trends towards civil war.
What was the origin of these reports? Did President Bush order them up? Did he ask for them?
No, these were initiated by the National Intelligence Council, a body of experts whose job it is to present independent, objective analysis for intelligence agencies. They produced them on their own, as they can do, rather than acting in response to a request from Congress or the White House.
How do President Bush's and his administration's public description, then, of what's going on in Iraq compare as depictions to what's outlined in this National Intelligence Report?
Well, that depends on who you ask, of course. The White House said today that there was nothing surprising in these reports and that indeed they have warned for months that Iraq's path toward the future is going to be a rocky one. The White House has emphasized progress, though, and this intelligence assessment was more pessimistic. It talked about the obstacles to progress.
Doug Gell, tell us exactly how you know what you know about what's in this report. Have you seen it?
I've not seen it, and that's an important question. I know what I know based on accounts from government officials from a number of agencies who have seen the document or been briefed on it, and the accounts they gave were consistent, so I'm fairly sure of what they've told me. But there's a lot that we don't know. It's a 50-page document, and I cannot pretend to know its full scope.
But as you report it, as you've been told by these people who have read it, the report outlines, as I understand it, three potential paths for Iraq. Can you describe those for us, Doug, in as much detail as you have?
Sure. The three paths, the most favorable would see Iraq in a tenuous situation for the next 18 months or longer, a time in which the political control was weak, the economy was in trouble, and security was unpredictable. The second course described, the middle course, would see increased fragmentation in Iraq, the rise of more extremism, and increased trouble on the part of the central government in maintaining control. The third would see those kinds of internal rivalries leading to violence, perhaps between sectarian groups, the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds.
Now, the White House is responding, saying their job is to give us the intelligence, describe the challenges. Our job is to craft a policy to deal with those challenges.
That indeed is true. What Democrats are asking, however, is shouldn't the White House have been somewhat more upfront in describing those challenges, perhaps in acknowledging that it received this report? And indeed, some Democrats, Bob Graham of Florida, Chris Dodd, in the Senate have called on the administration to declassify, to make public this intelligence estimate.
And then there's Chuck Hagel's description yesterday. The Senate was very active in conversation about Iraq yesterday. He's calling this in particular regard to the lack of spending to make things better in Iraq. He says it's beyond pitiful, it's beyond embarrassing, it's now in the zone of dangerous. Doug Gell, you know, candidate Kerry has referred to your article in a speech today before the National Guard get-together in Las Vegas. We'll air some of that later in this hour. He describes the Bush administration as living in a fantasy world of spin. When your sources talk to you about this report, is that the way they're putting it forward, or is it just the facts, ma'am?
Without disclosing the sources, I tend to talk to people who are several steps removed from that political world, and I cover intelligence, and the job of intelligence agencies, at least in theory, is to be independent and objective.
But they've come to you for a reason. Are they trying to expose a more gritty, perhaps more real picture of what's going on in Iraq than they believe they've heard on the campaign trail. Is that their motive?
Different people have different motivations, of course. It's fair to say that some of those I've spoken with believe that the administration has not been fully candid about the challenges ahead in Iraq and that this document was closer to the truth.
Indiana Republican Senator Dick Lugar, a great foreign policy stalwart, at that same hearing yesterday, talking disparagingly about the dancing in the street crowd, I guess, within the Bush administration, people who expected dancing in the street in Iraq. He said the nonsense of all that is apparent. The lack of planning for Iraq is apparent. Another way of describing a gulf between what the country's been presented and what's now seen.
That's true, and it is interesting that we've begun to hear that from some Republicans as well as Democrats. A congressman from Nebraska who recently resigned from the House Intelligence Committee, a Republican, said he thought that the Iraq War was a mistake. He's unusual among the party, but that candor is interesting.
Doug Gill, you've said there's been a call for the White House to actually release the intelligence report or portions of it. Do you think that will happen?
It's hard to say. I would doubt that it would happen. The argument that critics make, that Democrats in particular make, is that the White House, after all, did declassify portions of the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq's illicit weapons that effectively made the administration's case for war. Their argument this time is, if you're willing to declassify that one, why not this, even if its conclusions are not as consistent with your policies? I don't think we've heard the response from the White House, but in private, White House officials would say, don't hold your breath.
Douglas Gill, thanks for your reporting, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Douglas Gill covers national security and intelligence for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. Americans spend $200 billion a year on prescription drugs. That is a big bite of the nation's wealth. And the country, says our guest tonight, is not getting its money's worth. Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, is on a tear against the pharmaceutical industry in America. Big Pharma, she says, is deceitful, corrupt, and corrupting, and needs to be set straight and quick. The industry, she says, spends too much on marketing, too much on knockoff drugs, and too much on buying political protection in Washington. American consumers and their health, she says, are being shortchanged. This hour on Point, an indictment of the drug industry and what it would take to fix it. Is the American way of creating and selling drugs still working, or do we have a problem here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine and a senior lecturer in social medicine at the Harvard Medical School. She is author of the new book, The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. Marcia Angel, welcome back to On Point.
It's good to be here, Tom.
So you have come out all guns blazing here. This is about as big and broad an attack on the pharmaceutical industry as anybody's ever seen, as far as I know. But you've got the background and the experience to be taken very, very seriously as you deliver it, Marcia Angel. Give us your nutshell critique. We're going to get into many parts of it, but when you say, I ask you, what's wrong with this industry, what's your answer?
Right. Well, we are paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And what the industry would like us to believe is that we have to pay these prices in order to cover their research costs, which implies that they spend most of their money on research and that they have very little left over afterwards. Neither of those two things is true. They spend relatively little on research and development, only about 14% of their sales, and they have enough left over afterwards to be, year after year after year, the most profitable industry in the United States. They make more in profits, in fact, than they spend on research and development.
So, and that has been true for many, many years.
For many, many years.
It wasn't true in the very most recent year. I think the oil companies nosed ahead.
Right. They slipped slightly last year from first place to third place, still well above the median for the other Fortune 500 industries. And partly as a result, I think, of Pfizer having just bought Pharmacia. so that its profit margin dropped from, they were running every year at about 27%, and it dropped to 9%.
These are astonishing. In an economy when many Fortune 500 companies may have profit margins of 3, 4%, something like
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, of course, Pfizer, a giant there.
Right.
Now, you're not just saying that they're making a lot of money that they could be spending on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You've got it right in your title. You're basically saying they're liars. They're lying. They deceive us. What's the deceit?
Well, the deceit is partly that their PR wants us to believe that they're just scraping by, and they're not. Their PR wants us to believe that most of their expenditures go for research and development. In fact, they spend 2 to 2.5 times as much on marketing and administration. And as I said, they have, at the end of the day, enough left over to have more in profits than they spend on research and development.
These are essentially the facts. We're going to hear from a representative from the pharmaceutical industry later in this hour. But given that, what is it that Americans could be getting, in your view, Marcia Angel, that they are not?
Well, they're not getting innovative drugs. That's the other scandal. The drug companies engage in a sort of blackmail. They say, don't curtail our prices. Don't mess with us in any way. It will stifle innovation. It will close off the life-saving drugs that you get. In fact, the major product of this industry is not innovative drugs, but rather minor variations of top-selling drugs already on the market. These are called copycat drugs or me-too drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they make mainly now.
Give us some examples of that.
Well, Lipitor is a very good example.
Okay, Lipitor, the anti-cholesterol drug.
Right. It's the top-selling drug in the world, but it's a me-too drug. It's the fourth of six statin drugs of the same type. Now, the first one, which came on the market in 1987, was truly an innovative drug, but based mainly, and you'll see this as we talk more,
mm-hmm.
The innovation comes mainly from publicly funded research done in university and government labs, mainly the NIH. And that was true of the first of the statins, the cholesterol-lowering drugs of the Lipitor type. That's now available as a generic. But nobody buys it because it isn't promoted. The newer brand name drugs with longer patent lives ahead of them are the ones that are promoted.
And is that why we see, whether it's for cholesterol drugs or Viagra and all of its cousins, is that why we see these enormous marketing campaigns on television with a lot of drugs that are clustered around just a few medical conditions?
Yes, there are whole families of Me Too drugs, and it takes a lot of marketing to convince both doctors and patients that they should take one instead of another.
Now, we're in a free market here, and one would think that if some big companies are just clustering around a few limited opportunities, other companies would come in and charge off in other directions, develop all kinds of other great drugs. Why is that not happening?
Well, these are the ones that are profitable. These are established, lucrative markets. It's cheap and easy to make a me-too drug. I mean, the most expensive part are the clinical trials at the end. But the actual research that goes into it is trivial. You just jigger a molecule and you make a very similar drug. You have an already established market. And the evidence is that this acts more as an oligopoly than a competitive market. The marketing for one Me Too drug increases sales for the other Me Too drugs, and the whole market expands. And that's their principal product now.
So you're saying it costs an awful lot of money for not nearly what Americans should be getting, so it's very expensive.
Right.
Beyond that, why does this matter? Okay, it's expensive. Well, it's very expensive, I guess.
It's very expensive. And the opportunity costs are very great, too, because while this industry is concentrating on Me Too drugs, it's not doing the innovative work it claims to be doing. The innovations really come from universities and the NIH.
So the Americans paying through the nose for much less than they should be getting.
That's right.
In the view of Marcia Angel. She is author of the new book, The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the American way of creating and selling drugs still working? Is it working well enough considering what you pay for those drugs? Do you trust you're getting a square deal at the pharmacy counter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American pharmaceutical industry and a withering new critique of its ways by a highly placed longtime observer. My guest is Marcia Angel. She's former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, a senior lecturer in social medicine at Harvard Medical School. Her new book is The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It. You can join this conversation tonight. Are the big drug companies delivering value for the dollar in innovation, in pricing, in honest research? Marcia Angel calls the industry deceitful. Does it look that way to you? She calls drug pricing rapacious. Does it feel that way to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marcia Angel, you describe this industry at some level as essentially corrupt and corrupting.
Yes, it is.
Justify those. Those are very loaded words, both.
Well, the corruption is in the way that the industry has co-opted every institution that might stand in its way, from the U.S. Congress to the FDA to the medical profession and doctors. The industry has the largest lobby in Washington. It gives generously to political campaigns, and it gets what it pays for. Congress seldom will buck this industry. A good example of that is the Medicare prescription drug benefit that was enacted by Congress late last year.
Yeah, President Bush pushed it through.
That's right.
A lot of hullabaloo about it.
And it actually contains a provision that prohibits Medicare from negotiating with drug companies for lower prices.
And why is that? Veterans Affairs,
that's
I think,
right.
negotiates
right.
and gets big
it
discounts.
Gets very big
so
discounts.
So why not Medicare? Surely they would get the biggest discounts ever
that's
seen.
That's right, because it's the biggest bulk purchaser of all, and that's precisely why that provision is in that law, because the industry would not stand for Medicare being able to negotiate lower prices.
What will they gain by that provision? What will American consumers or taxpayers lose? How much?
Well, senior citizens, unfortunately,
yeah.
will lose a lot, and I think the rest of us will, too, because essentially it's a green light.
And there's many billions at stake in that clause.
Many, many billions. It's a green light for the drug companies to continue with their very rapid price increases. The biggest drugs, the price increases at roughly three times the inflation rate. So at that rate, and I would imagine that the rate will increase with this gift that Congress gave them, the drug benefit, which was inadequate to begin with, will quickly be overtaken by rising prices. It'll disappear.
So you're saying the oversight is essentially, in your view, corrupt. You also point at the research, which is kind of the basis for all,
right.
certainly all science, certainly for drugs we're going to take. What's the problem there in your
view?
Well,
that's when I first became concerned about this industry. When I first came to the New England Journal of Medicine, which was in 1979, drug companies did pay for most of the research on their drugs, but they did so at arm's length. They would give a grant, usually to faculty researchers at medical schools, and then they would stand back, cross their fingers, and hope that their drug looked good.
Sounds good.
And the researcher would design the research, would collect the data, analyze the data, write the paper, decide whether the paper was going to be published. But over the years, as I watched, over my two decades at the New England Journal of Medicine, I saw the industry begin to exercise increasing control over the way that research was done. The drug company said, all right, you know, here's a grant, but we will design the trial.
Are you saying we're buying snake oil? We're buying...
too often we don't really know. But bias is certainly creeping into the research because the drug companies are controlling the way the research is done. And we've heard recently, there's been a lot of publicity about the fact that they will only publish the favorable results and bury the unfavorable results. And one could see that happening. As I was at the journal, I saw more examples of what I thought was that. This is an industry that has distorted the medical literature in such a way that I believe that both doctors and patients believe prescription drugs are a lot better than they are.
A lot of very big charges here. We want to hear from the industry that you have taken on. We're joined now from Washington by Lori Reilly. She is Deputy Vice President for Policy and Research at Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA, the trade organization which represents the country's leading research-based pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies. She's the lead author of a 28-page rebuttal from PhRMA to Marshall Angell's book. Lori Reilly, good evening and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're hearing it tonight, and I'm sure it's been ringing in your ears for weeks now. Marshall Angell is laying down some pretty tough criticisms of the industry that you work in, Lori Reilly. What's the shape of your response?
Well, we fundamentally disagree with nearly all the points that Dr. Angell is making. Our research and the work that we've done in doing the rebuttal that you referenced is based primarily on peer-reviewed literature, government reports, and other things that back up our answers to a lot of the criticism that Dr. Angell has made against our industry.
Are you disputing that the pharmaceutical companies have historically, for the last couple of decades, made among the highest profit margins in the Fortune 500?
Certainly, this is a profitable industry, and we're not denying that. I do think it's interesting, and you mentioned earlier in the broadcast about the Fortune 500 rankings. If you look over the last 5 years, according to Fortune magazine, pharmaceutical sector profit growth was 3.4%, which ranked 26th in the Fortune 500.
That's growth, but not the absolute profit margin.
Well, the absolute profit margin was higher. We ranked, though, last year third. And, in fact, I think according to Fortune, they said many pharmaceutical companies look downright sickly in 2003.
Well, let me just ask you on that. Why should it be of all the industries in America? And I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I just wonder why should it be that the pharmaceutical industry would be particularly lucrative over time? Why?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry makes medicines that are enriching people's lives, elongating people's lives, and making them better. In order to come up with the research and development dollars, we obviously need to attract investment from individuals. And having a high return on profits allow our companies to engage in the kind of research and development that is often extremely risky, and we know it's long. It takes, on average, 10 to 15 years for a new drug to be approved at a cost of about $800 million.
Now, there's another area of critique. Marsha Angell says that $800 billion figure is kind of a sham. She says you don't put risk as much as you say. It's sort of a myth. You ride along on a lot of government research.
Right.
You know that line of critique. What's your response
sure.
there?
Well, the $800 million figure is not a figure that PhRMA made up. It's a figure that has been cited in the Journal of Health Economics in a study that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. The figure that Dr. Angell uses was done by Public Citizen, which is a advocacy group. It did not go through the peer review process that the $800 million figure did. And in fact, the accounting firm of Ernst & Young examined the figure that Public Citizen came up with and said it presented selective evidence and was not correct in its assessment.
Now, are you saying, Lori Reilly, that it's every new drug that hits the market costs $800 million to research and bring to consumers?
Well, no, the figure is representative of an average. Certainly some are higher, some are lower, and that's for new molecular entities, so new medicines that come onto the market.
New molecular entities, so that would
right.
be a really new drug, not a so-called Me Too or knockoff drug.
Well, you know, that's another point of clarification. Dr. Angell uses the term Me Too drug to describe competitive brand name drugs in a given class. So, for example, if one company comes out with a cholesterol-lowering drug known as a statin,
yeah.
and another company comes out with a drug, she labels that as a Me Too. However, those drugs are completely different entities. They're competing against one another, and there's value to having multiple drugs in the class. In fact, the FDA has stated time and time again they want to have multiple drugs in a class because it's beneficial for patients, for one, it's beneficial for providers, and another benefit it adds is that there is evidence in fact that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine that demonstrated that to the extent that you have multiple drugs competing in a therapeutic class, it leads to price competition.
Lori Reilly, there's several more points I want to hear from you on, but let me just get Marsha Angell's response on these two of the cost of innovating new drugs and also Lori Reilly saying, look, there's a benefit to having these similar drugs that come out in a particular class. Marsha Angell?
Well, in fact, there's almost no price competition among these drugs. You have never heard Lipitor advertised as being cheaper than Zocor or Zocor advertised as being cheaper than Lipitor. They are advertised as though they were better.
I did see a research results just recently, as I recall, that said, I forget which, but one of these is actually more effective than another.
They rarely compare me-too drugs against an older drug at equivalent doses. Sometimes they do. They compare a new drug with an old drug at too low a dose, and then the new drug will look better. But rarely do they even test them against older drugs head-to-head at comparable doses.
And what about the issue of the cost of innovating new drugs? Lori Reilly says $800 million for what's the phrase,
no.
a molecular...
A new molecular entity.
Yes.
This is a bogus figure.
Why?
The economists were paid largely by the pharmaceutical industry. I don't know about the peer review of economics journals, but I know that a medical journal would not have accepted a paper in which the data were secret. In other words, they looked at 68 drugs from 10 companies, but they never say what the companies are or what the drugs are. Those drugs were new molecular entities that were developed entirely within the companies. This is unusual. There are probably fewer than 10% of the drugs that come on the market, and they're the very most expensive drugs.
These companies
license probably over a third of all their drugs now. They acquire them from places,
rather than ground-up research.
Right.
Lori Reilly, so we hear the disagreement there. Let me ask you, there's another vein of attack in this book, which is very strong, which says that your industry has a corrupting influence on research and on its own oversight. That is, that you've got too much influence over the research that goes into drugs, and you've got too much sway in Washington. Your reply on those, Lori.
Sure. In order to get a drug on the market in this country, it has to be proven to be both safe and effective. And we go through a long, elaborate process with the Food and Drug Administration mm-hmm. in order to get a drug on the market. I haven't heard Dr. Angel make an argument that the drugs that we have on the market are somehow harming individuals. And I think if you look at some of the strides made in recent years in terms of extremely declining rates and things like AIDS mortality, cancer rates declining, heart disease on the decline, most of these are as a result of pharmaceuticals and better pharmaceuticals.
And you're saying if our research was corrupt, we'd have corrupt drugs, and we don't.
Exactly. I mean, if our research was as bad as it was, A, would people be buying these drugs? And B, would we see the kind of improvements that we've been seeing in our healthcare system over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years and beyond?
And your sway in Washington, it is enormous. Have you bought off Washington?
No. You know, obviously we've heard that claim before. I think if you look at a lot of the legislation that gets raised and a lot of the hearings that happen up on Capitol Hill, they're certainly not necessarily helpful to our industry. There's certainly a lot of legislation that gets passed that, you know, is detrimental to our industry, a lot of issues that get raised that we're not in favor of. You know, do we lobby Congress like other industries do? Of course we do. It's rare in Washington for an industry not to want to protect its interests and to lobby Congress. Is our sway, you know, more than others? I really don't think so.
Well, we'll get a reply on that, but I want to invite our callers in first. A lot of them want to join us. Steve is calling from South Boston. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Tom, I had to call in because I'm appalled. I'm self-employed, and I had to take a part-time job parking cars at all these shishi restaurants around town, and I was appalled just to afford a drug, I should tell you, because I was diagnosed, just to afford the drug.
Okay.
I take this job parking cars, and these pharmaceutical industries are throwing huge parties, inviting doctors at all the hospitals to come in and to essentially be sold from their quote-unquote experts what they're talking about and the new drugs.
Steve, how do you know that's what's going on in the restaurant, Steve?
I'm sorry?
How do you know that's what's going on in there?
Because I saw it. Geez, they have the the LCD projector. They have their expert talking about it. They're pushing hard on what drugs they're selling. They invite these doctors for free dinners.
So when you hear that they've got among the highest profit margins in the land, how does that strike you, Steve?
I'll tell you, it strikes me. I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, I'm parking these people's cars just to be able to afford the stuff, and this is how they go spend that money for their marketing.
Steve, we've got it. Larry Riley, you know there's a lot of this sentiment out there. We've got politicians across the country pushing to bring in drugs from Canada. Are you guys running into a real buzzsaw here? Is it possible that the heyday of your profits and untouchability is behind you? Are you worried about it?
Well, you know, certainly, and hearing callers like this gentleman say that they're unable to afford their drugs is obviously a concern to us.
But crocodile tears, you've got 17% profit margin, 27, 28 at Pfizer. I mean,
listen, our companies sponsor patient assistance programs, and I don't know if this gentleman has looked into these programs at all. These programs offer free medications, and last year, in fact, provided 6.2 million Americans with free medication for those that couldn't afford it, low-income Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about six times as many as went to Canada to purchase their drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly access to medicines is a very important issue. Access to health care in the United States is an important issue, given that 43 million Americans lack insurance. But we think the answer is coverage, and coverage for those people so that they have access to prescription drug coverage is the right answer to helping people get access to the medicines they need and other health care that they need.
Marcia Angel, Larry Riley says, look, we're not corrupt. Our medicines do not hurt people. They help people. And everybody lobbies on Capitol Hill. Don't single us out.
Well, I'm glad that she mentioned cancer and AIDS, because these are two diseases for which the drugs were based almost entirely on publicly funded research done in universities and at the NIH. And I'd like to mention one cancer drug in particular, Taxol. That was developed, it was discovered and developed entirely at the National Cancer Institute and Duke University, I believe it was. It cost.
She's saying they're not paying their way. We've touched that, but the corruption issue. She's saying, come on, we don't have bad drugs, so we're not corrupt. We're not corrupting research. We've got safe drugs.
Well, no. I think when they test Me Too drugs against placebos, when they don't try to find out whether they're better than older drugs, and then promote them to both doctors and patients as though they were better, I think that's corrupting. And it's certainly corrupting of the medical profession to accept the responsibility of educating them when really they are companies that make money selling these drugs.
Mm.
But I blame the doctors, too. I should be very clear about that.
Well, there's an attack to go around here. We've also heard the reply from the drug company tonight saying it is not that way. That's not the way it is. Lori Riley, thanks for joining us with that view. Thanks very much for being with us. We're talking tonight about the American pharmaceutical industry and a withering critique of its ways by a highly placed, longtime observer, Marcia Angel, author of The Truth About the Drug Companies. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight is Marcia Angel. She is author of the new book, The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It. You can join this conversation. Has Big Pharma bought and paid for the U.S. Congress? Is the industry plowing enough money into great research or too much into profits and Viagra ads? Do we have a problem here? How can we fix it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Rosmik is calling from Boston. Hi, Rosmik. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Angel.
Hello.
I read your book last Saturday in a bookstore. Found it very interesting, considering I work in a cognate field to the industry. The thing that concerns me about your book is that you make this assertion that there's this vast conspiracy by the pharmaceutical companies to bewilder and deceive, yet there's no serious acknowledgement in that book that if that is true, that the pharmaceutical companies set up these sham trials and suppress results, that every physician who's ever participated in one of those trials is a willing co-conspirator, as is your journal for having published any of those trials. And that
Rosmik, stand by. Let's hear from Marcia Angel on that. Stay with us.
Well, first of all, I never use the term conspiracy, and I've never made the assertion that every clinical trial out there is fabricated or otherwise.
But you paint a picture of a lot of suspect trials, and as Rosmik says, a lot of doctors participate.
What the picture I paint is of trials that are primarily biased in their design. For example, if you design a trial to compare a new drug with a placebo instead of with an old drug, you're really not answering the question that doctors and patients want to know, which is this drug better than what I'm already using? You are answering a commercial question. You are showing that the new drug is better than nothing, which is not the medically interesting question, but it will get you FDA approval. Mm. This is a bias trial. Or, for example, if another example would be if you did a study of a drug that is probably going to be used mainly in older people, but you do it in human subjects who are 25 years old and less likely to have side effects, you have designed it in such a way that you've increased the chances that the drug will look good.
And what
I'm criticizing.
What about Rosmik's concern that even journals like, you no longer edit, but that you once edited, the New England Journal of Medicine, very influential in the world of health.
That's right.
That they've got kind of a part in this whole system as well.
Well, they have to be very, very careful. The New England Journal was unique in the sense that it could have existed without pharmaceutical ads. Very few journals can say that. But you do have to watch for these things.
But does the financial influence of the drug companies extend to what we read in journals?
In some journals, yes.
The New England Journal of Medicine?
I don't believe so. But in some journals, you certainly have to watch out for bias in trials, and you can't always spot all bias. Let me give you an example. There was a study of Celebrex that was meant to last for a year. In the first 6 months, and the study was done and sponsored by the company that makes it, when the study was done, the first 6 months made the drug look good. The second 6 months, and it no longer looked so good.
Mm-hmm.
They published just the first 6 months' worth of data in the Journal of the American Medical Association without telling the editors that there was another 6 months on the cutting room floor. An editorialist wrote an editorial praising Celebrex, and then it turned out that there was another 6 months that would have wiped away the superiority.
A different story.
Right. And the editor felt betrayed. She said so. The editorialist, he was quoted as saying he felt like a sucker. This is the kind of thing you have to watch out for. There is no way this journal could have known that the second 6 months was already done and sitting on the cutting room floor being buried.
Rosmik, you're raising some good issues there. I've got a lot more people to get in here, so I'm going to move on, but thank you for that call, and you must be some speed reader. Peter Rost is joining us from Short Hills, New Jersey. He is Vice President of Marketing for Endocrine Care at Pfizer. He's spoken out as a private citizen in favor of drug importation. He's posted a favorable review of Marsha Angel's new book on Amazon.com. He's been in the pharmaceutical industry for 20 years. Peter Rost, thanks for joining us tonight.
And thank you very much for having me and for pointing out that I am also tonight speaking out as a private citizen, and I do in no way represent my employer in any opinions that I may expressed tonight.
We've got that loud and clear, but are they surrounding your house and riding you out of the industry on a rail, Peter Rost? I mean, this is such a harsh critique of your industry. Where do you get off standing up to sort of defend it and praise it from the inside?
Well, I was very impressed with Marsha's book. I have, as you said, many years in the industry, and I felt that many things that she brought up are things that I was familiar with in general. And that's why I also wrote the review about the book.
Is your industry corrupt?
I think the first, also, let me point out that I will not in any way comment about Pfizer or any prior employers, but we're talking about the industry in general.
Yes.
The industry is driven by basic financial forces, same as any other industry. I don't think the pharma industry is different than other industries. What is different here is that we're dealing with drugs, we're dealing with health and lives, And that puts a different onus on the kind of information that is being put forward.
Are you lonely inside your industry in this view, or are there others that share it?
Well, I have been impressed, surprised, and pleased during the last few days, especially as I have spoken up, when I've been contacted by a number of colleagues in significant positions, and often in PR and communication for other companies, saying that they agree with what I'm saying.
Well, you're a brave guy to put it up there on Amazon.com and to be with us tonight, even for just a few minutes. Peter Rost, private citizen and vice president of marketing, a vice president at Pfizer. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
I want to get to solutions because we've just got a few minutes and you've got a big pile of them. Okay, clearly we're spending a ton of money. We've got some kind of a problem here. There's all kinds of a pushback breaking out, whether it's Americans and governments going to Canada, whether it's Elliot Spitzer going after GlaxoSmithKline, or the FDA this week is beginning to discuss whether to require stronger labels on antidepressant use in children. There's a lot going on. What's your suggestion for how we get this industry and America's pharmaceuticals into ship shape?
Well, it does need fundamental reform. As I say in the book, we need to save this industry from itself. In the last chapter of the book, I go through seven areas where very specific reforms should be implemented. Let me just mention a couple.
Please.
One of the issues right now is importing drugs from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And while I would favor permitting this, I think that the arguments against it are phony. It's not the long-term solution to our problems by any means. There is no way that Canada can supply drugs for the United States, and it makes no sense, really, to buy the same drugs from Canada with the extra transaction cost.
Seems like a very roundabout way.
Right.
So what's the alternative?
So the alternative, really, is not so much to import the drugs as to import the system for regulating the drugs.
So price control, is that what you're suggesting?
That is the word that they would use. You can call it price negotiation, price regulation, the kind of thing that Medicare does for doctor's fees, for hospitalization costs. The prescription drug benefit is the only place where Medicare is not allowed.
So use that leverage.
Regulate.
So one way or another, let's have some regulation on
that's
prices.
That's right. And we are the only country that doesn't. Americans spend roughly twice as much as Europeans and Canadians for exactly the same drugs, the same FDA-approved
drugs. Our time is short. Price regulation, what else would you suggest?
Well, one of the most important reforms, and it probably doesn't sound all that important at first blush, but it's for the FDA to require that new drugs be tested against old ones before they are approved and allowed on the market.
That is not just against a placebo, but against their existing competition.
Right.
To see whether they're
better or worse or the same.
So what if they're the same?
Worse.
Well, okay, if they're worse,
why bother?
The
point, Tom, is we don't know.
But what if they're the same? It's a free country. It's a free market. You're saying the drug company shouldn't be permitted to bring
it
out?
Well, it isn't a free market. Let me point out that this industry plays both sides of that street. They talk the rhetoric of free market, which means they get to make whatever drugs they want and charge whatever prices they want. But they are utterly dependent on publicly funded research, on government-granted monopoly rights in the form of exclusive marketing rights.
Around patents.
And FDA-granted exclusive marketing rights, and all kinds of tax breaks. This is an industry on welfare like no other industry.
And research, how would you clean it up?
I don't believe that the industry should have control over trials on their own drugs. That's too much of a conflict of interest. So I would favor setting up another institute within the NIH that would oversee the drug trials.
So government oversight of research instead of the
just
companies.
Just like the NIH.
There's a lot going on in this area. You can hear the drums beating in the woods. The pharmaceutical companies must be concerned about it. Is there enough pushback, kickback from the American public to change this very powerful industry?
There is starting to be for the first time. I think the issue of importing drugs from Canada is probably the thing that made people sit up and pay attention to this industry. You know, the industry got a law passed in 1987 that said that no one but manufacturers could import drugs. And that protected them from knowledge in this country of how much more we were paying. But as mainly senior citizens began to take bus trips across the border, they couldn't hide that from Americans anymore.
They got an eyeful in Montreal and in Toronto, and that is flowing right on through. Marcia Angel, I'm sorry to say this, but you said a lot, and we hear it. We're out of time at this point. We're so grateful to you for coming on.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, Tom.
It's great to have you. Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, author of The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It. In a moment, John Kerry addresses the National Guard Association. This is On Point. On the same day that the New York Times reported on a national intelligence estimate that paints a dark picture of Iraq's prospects, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry accused President Bush of not being truthful with the American people about Iraq. Addressing the National Guard Association in Las Vegas today, Kerry said that the situation in Iraq is deteriorating, but that the president is, quote, living in a fantasy world of spin. On Tuesday, we brought you President Bush speaking before the National Guard Association. Tonight, we bring you John Kerry addressing the same group earlier today.
True leadership is about looking people in the eye and telling them the truth even when it's hard to hear. 2 days ago, President Bush came before you and you received him well, as you should. And I'm grateful for your reception here today. But I believe that the president failed that fundamental test of leadership. He failed to tell you the truth. You deserve better. The commander-in-chief has to level with the troops and the nation and his president. I intend to do that on the good days and on the bad days. 2 days ago, the president stood right here where I'm standing, and he didn't acknowledge that more than 1,000 men and women have lost their lives in Iraq. He didn't tell you that with each passing day, we're seeing more chaos, more violence, indiscriminate killings. He didn't tell you that with each passing week, our enemies are actually getting bolder, that Pentagon officials report that entire regions of Iraq are now in the hands of terrorists and extremists. He didn't tell you that with each passing month, stability and security seem further and farther away. He didn't tell you this, even though, as the country learned today, on the front page of the New York Times, his own intelligence officials have warned him for weeks that the mission in Iraq is in serious trouble. That is the truth, as hard as it is to bear. In the Bible, it says it's the truth that sets you free. And in America, we are a country that has been built on our ability to take the truth and turn it around and deal with it. I believe you deserve a president who isn't going to gild that truth or gild our national security with politics, who is not going to ignore his own intelligence, who isn't going to live in a different world of spin, who will give the American people the truth, not a fantasy world of spin, but a world where we challenge our brave men and women to be able to meet the test of our times.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry speaking to the National Guard Association in Las Vegas earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.